He sat in the fork 30 feet above the ground, while the sound of voices grew stronger, became the sound of singing. This was no sound of joy, but a terrible mourning dirge, slow and heartbreaking, rising and fading as flukes of the breeze and folds of the ground blanketed the sound. But each time it came back a little stronger, until Camacho could make out far away the head of the column, like the head of a maned serpent writhing out of the forest into an open glade a mile ahead. He slid down the trunk of the Amsisa and hurried forward. There was an armed party ahead of the main column, 5 blacks dressed in the tatters of cast-off European-style clothing and carrying muskets. But at their head was a white man, a little man with a face like a vicious gnome, wrinkled and burned darkly by the sun. The thick, drooping black moustache was laced with grey, but he stepped out with a bouncing, elastic stride as he recognised Camacho from 200 paces and snatched his hat off his head and waved it. He shouted, "Camacho!" And the two men ran to embrace and then hold each other at arm's length, laughing with pleasure. It was Camacho who sobered first, the laughter changing to a scowl as he said, "Alphonse, my beloved brother, I have bad tidings, the worst possible."
"The Englishman?"
Alphonse was still smiling. He had a tooth missing from the front of his upper jaw, which made the cold, humourless smile seem less dangerous than it really was.
"Yes, the Englishman," Camacho nodded. "You know of him?" "My father sent the message. I know."
Alphonse was the governor of Quelimane's eldest surviving son, full-blooded Portuguese by the lawfully wedded bride who had come out 40 years previously from Lisbon, a pale, sickly mail-order bride who had borne 3 sons in swift succession, the first 2 of which had succumbed to malaria and infantile dysentery even before the appearance of the little wizened yellow mite, whom they had named Alphonse José Villa Pereira, and expected to bury with his brothers before the end of the rains. However, it was the mother they had buried in the end, and the child had flourished at the breast of a black wet nurse.
"He did not go north, then?"
Alphonse demanded, and Camacho dropped his eyes guiltily, for he was speaking to the eldest full-blooded and legitimate son. Camacho himself was a bastard and a half-breed, son of one of the governor's once beautiful mulatto concubines, now fat and faded and forgotten, in one of the back rooms of the Seraglio. He was not even recognized as a son, but had to bear the ignominious title of nephew. This in itself was enough for him to show respect for the other. But added to this, Alphonse was as determined as their father had been at the same age, though even crueler and harder. Camacho had seen him sing a plaintive fado as he flogged a man to death, accompanying the traditional love song with the flute and percussion of the lash.
"He did not go north," Camacho agreed uneasily.
"You were told to see that he did."
"I could not stop him. He is English."
Camacho's voice croaked a little.
"He is stubborn."
"We will speak again of that,"
Alfonso promised coldly.
"Now swiftly tell me where he is and what he plans to do."
Camacho recited the explanation he had prepared, skirting delicately around the most offensive parts of the story, and dwelling on the subjects such as the wealth that the Ballantyne expedition carried with it, rather than his own brutal beating at the Englishman's hands. Alphonse had thrown himself down in the shade of a tree beside the track, and listened broodingly, chewing at the straggling ends of his moustache, filling in for himself the conspicuous gaps in his half-brother's recital, and speaking again only at the end.
"When will he leave the valley of the Zambezi?"
"Soon," Camacho hedged,
for the unpredictable Englishman might already be halfway to the escarpment.
"Although I cut him deeply, it may be he has himself carried in a mushila,
a litter."
"He must not be allowed to enter the Monomotapa,"
Alphonse said flatly, and came to his feet with a single lithe movement.
"The best place to do the business would be in the bad ground below the rim of the valley."
He glanced back along the winding road. The head of the column was a mile away still, across a glade of open golden grass. The shuffling double rank of bowed creatures, yoked at the neck, did not seem human, though the singing was sad and beautiful.
"I can spare 15 men,
It will not be enough, Camacho cut in swiftly.
It will be, said his brother coldly, if you do the business in the night.
20 men, Camacho pleaded. He has soldiers with him, trained soldiers, and he is a soldier himself.
Alphonse was silent, weighing risk and advantage. But the worst part of the hyena road already lay behind the column, and each mile nearer the coast the land was tamer, the risk diminished, and the need for guards less pressing.
20, he agreed abruptly, and turned to Camacho. But not one of the foreigners must escape.
Looking into his brother's cold black eyes, Camacho felt his skin crawl.
Leave no sign. Bury them deep, so the jackal and hyena do not dig them out. Use the porters to carry the expedition equipment to the place in the hills. And when they have done so, kill them also. We will bring it down with the next caravan to the coast.
Si, I understand.
Do not fail us again, my beloved cousin, brother.
Alphonse made the endearment a threat, and Camacho swallowed with a nervous little gulp.
I will leave as soon as I have rested.
No,
Alphonse shook his head.
You will leave immediately.
Once that Englishman enters the land beyond the mountains, there will soon be no more slaves. It is bad enough that there has been no gold for 20 years and more. But if the river of slaves were to dry up, both my father and I would be displeased. Very displeased.
At Zuga's order, the long, mournful blast of the kudu horn trumpet shattered the silence of the utterly dark hour before the dawn. The Indunas took up the cry, Safari! We march! And they prodded the sleeping porters off their reed sleeping mats. The campfires had burned down to dim red mounds of coals, smothered in the soft grey powder of their own ash. As fresh logs were thrown upon them, they flared up in a false dawn that lit the underside of the umbrella-shaped acacia trees with wavering yellow light. The smell of roasting ropoco cakes rose on tendrils of pale smoke straight into the windless dark sky. The muted voices became louder, more cheerful, as the flames drove away the chills and the nightmares.
Safari!
The cry was taken up, and the divisions assembled, ghostly figures in the gloom, emerging more clearly as the growing dawn light paled the sky and snuffed out the stars.
Safari!
And the mass of men and equipment resolved itself, and order grew out of chaos. Like those long columns of big, shiny, black serowe ants that endlessly cross and recross the African earth, the stream of porters moved steadily away into the still gloomy forest. As each of them passed Zuga and Robin standing together at the gate of the thorn skerm, they shouted a greeting and executed a few prancing steps to demonstrate their loyalty and enthusiasm, while Robin laughed with them and Zuga called encouragement. We no longer have a guide and we don't know where we're going. She took Zuga's arm. What is to become of us? If we knew, it would take all the fun out of it.
At least a guide.
While you thought I was hunting, I went out as far as the escarpment, which is further than that swaggering Portuguese ever went. Further than any white man, except, of course, Pater, has ever been. Follow me, Sissy. I am your guide.
She looked up at him now in the strengthening light of coming dawn.
I knew you were not hunting, she told him.
The escarpment is rugged and very broken, but I have examined 2 passes through the telescope that I think will go...
And beyond that?
He laughed. We'll find out. Then he squeezed her around the waist.
That's the whole fun of the thing.
She studied his face with full attention for a few moments. The new full beard emphasized the strong, almost stubborn lines of his jaw. There was a piratical devil-may-care lift to the corner of his lips, and Robin realized that no man of conventional mind would have proposed and engineered this expedition. She knew he possessed courage. His exploits in India had proved that beyond doubt, and yet when she looked at his sketches and watercolors and read the rough notes he was making for the book, she discovered a sensitivity and an imagination she had never before suspected. He was a difficult person to know and understand. Perhaps she could have told him about Sarah and the child, or even about Mungo St. John and that night in the main cabin of Huron. For when he laughed like this, the stern features softened with humour and humanity, and green lights sparkled in his eyes. "That's what we are here for, Sissy. The fun of it all."
"And the gold," she teased.
"And the ivory."
"Yes, by God, the gold and the ivory as well. Come on, Sissy. This is where it truly begins." And he limped after the column as its tail disappeared into the acacia forest, favouring his injured leg and using a freshly cut staff to move across the sandy earth. For a moment Robin hesitated, and then she shrugged aside her doubts and ran to catch up with her brother. The first day the porters were rested and eager, the valley floor flat and the going easy. So Zugo ordered Tirikeza, the double march, so that even at their slow pace the column left many miles of dusty grey earth behind them that day. They marched until the heat came up in the middle of the morning, and the merciless sun dried the sweat the moment it burst through their pores and left tiny salt crystals on the skin that sparkled like diamond chips. Then they found shade and lay like dead men through the heat of noon, stirring again only when the lowering sun gave the illusion of cooling the air and the blast of the kudu horn trumpet forced them to their feet again. The second stage of the Tirikezi lasted until sunset, when it became too dark to see the ground under their feet. The fires were dying, and the voices of the porters in their thornbush scarams had slowly descended through the occasional mutter and soft murmur to ultimate silence before Zuga left his tent and limped silently as night creature out of the camp. He carried the Sharps rifle slung over his shoulder, the staff in one hand and a bullseye lantern in the other, while the Colt revolver hung in its holster upon his belt. Once clear of the camp, he stepped out as briskly as his leg would allow 2 miles along the freshly beaten footpath that the column had made that afternoon, until he reached the fallen tree trunk that was the agreed rendezvous. He stopped and whistled softly, and a smaller figure stepped out from the undergrowth into the moonlight, carrying a rifle at high port. The jaunty step and alert set of head on narrow shoulders was unmistakable. "All is well, Sergeant?"
"We are ready, Major."
Zuga inspected the ambush positions that Sergeant Chirrut had chosen for his men astride the path. The little Hottentot had a good eye for ground, and Zuga found his trust and liking for him increasing with every such display of competence.
"A path?"
Jan Chirrut asked now, with the clay pipe already in his mouth. "No smoking," Zuga shook his head. "They will smell it." And Jan Chirrut reluctantly buttoned the pipe into his hip pocket. Zuga had chosen a position in the centre of the line, where he could make himself comfortable against the trunk of the fallen tree. He settled down with a sigh, his leg thrust out stiffly ahead of him. After the Tirikezi, it was going to be a long, wearying night. The moon was a few days short of full, and it was almost light enough to read the headlines of a newspaper. The bush was alive with the scurry and rustle of small animals, and it kept their nerves tightened and their ears strained to catch the other sounds for which they waited. Zuga was the first to hear the click of a pebble striking against another. He whistled softly, and Jan Chirrut snapped his fingers, imitating the sound of a black scarab beetle, to show that he was alert. The moon had dropped low upon the hills, and its light through the forest trees laid silver and black tiger stripes upon the earth and played tricks with the eye. Something moved in the forest and then was gone. But Zuga picked up the whisper of bare feet, scuffling the sandy, disturbed earth of the path, and then suddenly they were there, and very close, man-shapes, in file, hurrying, silent, furtive. Zuga counted them. 8, no, 9. Each of them straight-backed, under the bulky burden he carried balanced upon his head. Zuga's anger simmered to the surface, and yet at the same time he felt a grim sense of satisfaction that he had not wasted the night. As the leading figure in the file came level with the fallen tree trunk, Zuger pointed the muzzle of the Sharps rifle straight into the air and pressed the trigger. The crash of the shot broke the night into 100 echoes that bounced and rebounded through the forest, and the silence magnified it until it seemed like the thunder of all the heaven. The echoes had not dispersed, and the 9 dark figures were still frozen with shock when Jan Schroot's Hottentots fell upon them from every direction in a shrieking pack.